I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Do you remember your first summer job and that sweet feeling of earning your first paycheck? Maybe you mowed lawns in the blistering summer heat or flipped hamburgers over a hot skillet for a few bucks an hour. Regardless, it's almost always an experience you don't forget. Today, we want to hear stories about your first job, what it was, and what it meant to you. After that, a Pembroke Hill senior tells us what suffragitsu is and how a year's worth of research into it earned her top marks at the National History Day competition. Later, Bill Brownlee in this week's Local Listen. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Remember your first job, that job you picked up in high school, or maybe it was during the summer. Maybe you were a soda jerk or you worked a checkout at the grocery store. It's an experience you never forgot because you get so much out of it. Mine was working as a stock boy at good old St. Croix Drugstore in Stillwater, Minnesota. So what was yours and what did you get from the experience? 816-235-2888 is our phone number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. And while the calls are coming in, we're joined by Nick Dorn. He's Director of Education for KC Social Innovation and Program Coordinator for Higher KC Youth Summer Initiative, aimed at what else? Getting kids jobs for kids during the summer. And these are jobs, first jobs for many of these young people. And Nick, so nice to have you. Welcome.
Thanks a lot, Steve.
What was your first summer job?
My first summer job was picking up nails on a construction site.
I was 13.
And I got the job to round up the nails. It was pretty pointless.
That's a line you've used a lot here, I can tell. What is the Higher KC Youth Summer Initiative, Nick?
The initiative is all about connecting youth to opportunities to work, to gain some kind of experience in a workplace, an immersive experience for that matter, where they could gain the skills that they need maybe for that career jump in the future. Or at least to pursue a course of study, maybe.
Oh, why do kids need help with this? Why does City Hall need to engage?
Well, I think it's a community effort. It's a city effort, and the greater Kansas City area needs to respond to the 30,000-some-odd kids who are disengaged in the summertime.
30,000?
30,000. These numbers come from a 2013 study, if I'm not mistaken, and I can get you the details if you'd like. But we've discovered through the mayor's office that there were that many kids who were without a job, not in school, and looking for something to do.
Who's eligible for this program?
Well, currently the program is a 16 to 24-year-old age range. Obviously, there are 9th and 10th graders out there in high school, 14 and 15-year-olds who are looking for something to do too. That might be something worth looking into and partnering with other organizations in the future. But yeah, we're working with our juniors and seniors in high school and those people who have graduated and those who now are in college or beyond.
And there are still nails out there to be picked up.
Oh, there are nails, sir.
Yeah, okay. Let's go to some phone calls here. We're looking for your ideas and your thoughts on what was your first summer job, your memories of getting out into the work world for the first time. Let's go to Charles from Independence. Charles, you're on Up to Date.
Hey, how you doing, Steve?
Good, Charles.
My first job was selling cars for a living. I got out of high school, summer school, and my first summer job, there wasn't any jobs to be found, and the job I got was stealing cars, and I didn't do it for a long period of time, but that was my first job, though.
You're saying stealing cars, Charles. Am I getting that right?
Yes, I stole cars for a living.
Nothing else to do, and that's that's what you're trying to avoid, Nick. Charles, hang on a second. That's what you're trying to avoid, right?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, these opportunities are crucial for a student-aged individual to make wise decisions for themselves.
How much money did you get for each car you stole, Charles?
I got about $250 for each car I stole. And it was pretty good. I didn't want to know anybody's name, and so I didn't want to know anybody to get involved with it, so they just putting my money in the mailbox, and that's basically how I got paid.
So what do you think?
I learned my lesson.
What lesson did you learn?
Well, one particular day, I came home, and there were two FBI agents in my living room, and they proceeded to tell me about all the cars that I stole, and they wanted me to sign a piece of paper saying that I stole the cars, but I wouldn't do that because that would be incriminating myself, and I told them, nah, I didn't do that. And so they left, and I realized how close they were, so I decided just to stop that nonsense.
So this idea the city's going to is offering this program to help kids and connect kids to summer jobs. What do you think of that idea?
I think it's a great idea, because if that was happening when I was younger, I wouldn't have been having that opportunity to come across. I would have went to work and got a legit job, you know?
Yeah.
And not almost going to jail because of, you know, just trying to stay out of trouble. I didn't really stay out of trouble, but I didn't really get in trouble either. But
right,
if that program would have been going on back in them days, back in the 70s, 71, it'd been really a good program. I would have got into it immediately.
Well, Charles, this is what we call a memorable phone call in our line of business. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it.
You're welcome, Steve. Bye-bye.
Nick Doran, you're trying to expand your program. What are you trying to do?
Well, currently, I want to make sure I made this clear that the KCSIC, or the Social Innovation Center, is partnering with the FEC, or Full Employment Council, along with the mayor's office and this Hire KC Youth program that's been around for a while now, to pilot a broader program that goes beyond City Hall and makes it more citywide. So we want to partner with organizations that are willing to offer an internship for a student-aged person who might be pursuing that course of study. But at the same time, we're looking for partners and champions out there who just want to give a kid a seasonal job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, again, we're talking about first summer jobs. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Dan Margulies from KCUR staff has joined us to talk to us about his first summer job. Dan, always good to have you
here.
Hey,
Steve. Good to be here.
What'd you do?
What did I do? My first summer job was quite a kickoff to my career. I had just gotten my driver's license. I was 16 years old. And I saw a classified ad in the Kansas City store, or maybe it was the Times, for an ice cream truck driver somewhere in KCK.
That sounds good.
So I thought, hey, with driver's license in hand, I was raring to go. So they were looking for folks to fill in for people who were on vacation, who were sick or otherwise unavailable. And I got the job. And what nobody had bothered to tell me, you'd think they would have asked this, is, can you drive a stick? Well, I discovered when they sent me out on my first run that I was driving a stick.
And the answer was no.
The answer was no, right. And I was absolutely mortified, but too mortified to tell anybody that I couldn't drive a stick. And so I proceeded to lurch out of the parking lot of the ice cream truck place and then spent the remainder of my drive to my route terrified that I was going to run over some little kid. And, you know, it was full of stops and starts. I think I drove in first gear almost the entire way. And
explain what happens next year.
I finally wound up breaking down somewhere in Leawood, Kansas. When I say breaking down, I'm not sure if it was the truck or me, but I was absolutely terrified. The only thing I could think to do at that point was call my Uncle Sammy, who was in town for a family event and who had driven a Jeep in the Army, and so I knew he could drive a manual. And I had to knock on some doors before anybody would let me in. Of course, this is way before cell phones. And he came out and rescued me. Needless to say, I quit my job that very same day.
And the enduring lesson there is what, Dan?
Enduring lesson is, you know, don't take a job with driving a vehicle without first learning if the vehicle is a stick or not. The irony is, Steve, today I drive a stick.
It all worked out.
I have a Honda Fit. Yeah, it all worked out.
Dan, thanks very much. That's KCUR's Dan Margulies. Our announcer here, Linda Scheer, also has a traumatic first job story to share with us. Linda, what happened with you?
Well, let's see. I guess I'd have to title this How I Became Unenamored with My Career Choice, which was babysitting at the time. And
you were 12 years old, I think, right?
I was 12.
Yeah.
And, you know, this was a common thing for a lot of tweens and teens to do in the summers, babysit for the neighborhood families, you know. And it was kind of one of my first jobs, and I really didn't ask any questions when this mother called me. So I get there, and this mom had six children, including a baby.
Warning sign number one.
Oh, boy.
Baby being warning sign number two, yeah.
Oh, my gosh. And plus, she was on her way to Lake Lackawanna, which was about 30 miles away. And again, this is back in the day with no cell phones, like Dan was saying. So once she took off, you know, that was it. I was on my own. So it wasn't, I don't think it was like even 30 minutes before the older kids ran out the door.
You don't know where they went.
Have no idea. Destinations unknown.
The youngest kid's getting bored, getting a little restless, and then something, the baby screaming. And what does the youngest one, end, the second youngest one end up doing here?
Well, he was frustrated with me because I wasn't, you know, entertaining him because I had a screaming baby to feed. So he runs out the door, but he forgot to open the door.
Oh.
He ran through the glass door.
It happens sometimes.
It did.
And so you've got a bloody kid and a screaming baby, and you've lost the other kids. And, yeah.
And no, you know, no way to contact the mom. So I took as many kids as I could to my neighbor next door and said, help, you know, and she took the child to the emergency room and got him stitched up. And we got the mom back from Lake Lackawanna, and that was, I think, my last babysitting job ever.
That's over for good.
That was it.
Thank you, Linda. I appreciate that.
Sure.
So Nick, back to you again. You're trying to expand this program. Are you getting much interest?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Our applicant pool is around, well over 1,200 candidates are in our applicant pool.
People who want to
16 or actually some under 16 year olds to 24 year olds who have applied looking for a job.
And how about, are there enough jobs to satisfy the demand?
Well, Steve, that's part of this this pursuit of ours to bring a city together to help make these jobs more available. I mean, we have partners who offered internships, and we had champions who offered those seasonal jobs. We had a career fair on April 22nd.
That was a big success, right?
It was big. We had a total of 1,000 jobs and internships combined under one roof. In terms of how those jobs got placed and who filled those jobs, I'll have to get you that information later.
Mm-hmm.
But it's encouraging in one regard, but it also presents us with a number of new objectives too. How do we centralize resources for employers and youth alike so that they know how to best get a job, how to search for one, how to work with someone whose job it may be their first job for that matter?
So is the demand exceeding the availability of jobs?
I think that's the case right now.
Yeah.
I think there are jobs out there that that maybe we just simply need to market, advertise, make more available, and bring these employers together around the table and find out ways to promote this to the youth.
If employers want to connect with your program, how can they do that?
They can reach out to us. The Hire KC Youth hotline is 816-800-9996.
Okay.
We would be happy to field their conversations and calls and questions. And also hear their ideas and their experiences.
Okay. Yeah. Let's go back to some phone calls here. Let's go to Joan from Lee Summit. Joan, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm Joan, and I'm originally from England and from London. And my first job was in 1933 at the age of 8 when I worked in a laundry.
Ah, and how did that go?
Well, I was earning 10 cents a week, sixpence. At lunchtime when I ran home from school, I ran the errands for the lady who ran the laundry. And then after school, I went in and I helped her sort the laundry. And I worked there for 3 years until I started another school. And I also worked for a cobbler. I ran his errands. I would go down to the shop and get his leather for him on my roller skates. And I did that until I was 12 years of age. And for that, I got another 10 cents a week, which in those days was rather a fortune.
Joan, you started at age 8. That's pretty young.
No, my sister started work at age 8. She was house cleaning with a lady. Both my brothers worked. We all worked. Otherwise, we didn't have anything. We expected to work, and we did. Yes.
Joan, I'm glad you called. Thanks very much.
You're welcome. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Have a lovely day.
You too. Bye-bye. Let's go to Ron from Holden, Missouri. Ron, you're on Up to Date.
Thank you. Good morning. Good program. I started working at 15 as a laborer in the school system in Dayton, Ohio.
Wow.
And my job was to clean toilets, and I cleaned proudly every public toilet in all the schools of Dayton, Ohio, my first job summer.
How did you handle that, the idea of cleaning toilets as your first job? I mean, that's tough. That's tough for young people.
No, it's not tough. My family was a military family, and you were fully expected to get your first job when you were 14. It was expected, so we did.
Okay. I'm glad you called, Ron. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
One of our business manager here, Danny Baker, gave us this story. His first work experience was working for the traffic engineering department in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, where he had grown up. He changed light bulbs, traffic light bulbs, painted the steel standards on which traffic signals were hung across wide streets, lots of silver paint, he says, fixed parking meters that had been vandalized and painted lines on newly asphalted streets. We also played spades and knocked gin during lunch hour. In those games, I lost a lot of money, Danny writes, that I was supposed to earn in the upcoming paycheck. Fortunately, my workmates extended credit, teaching me the nuances of debt management. At the end of that summer, my supervisor asked what I had learned from the experience, and I said, well, project management, assigning workers, and planning the day's activities. But he shot back, wrong. What you learned, he said, is that you stay in college and complete your degree so you never have to have a job like this again. Got it? Danny writes, I got it, and I've never forgotten it as well. Good advice, right, Nick?
Absolutely. Yeah. But I think that there's dignity to every job.
Mm-hmm.
And I think finding the...
That concept hasn't changed.
I think there's value in it that's deeper than one might perceive at first. And I think it's a common value that you can find here in the Midwest for sure. But I think it's also a chance for kids to expand their horizons at large, learn new experiences, meet their future mentor perhaps or adult ally. And also discover what their limits are. I think that's okay, too.
Does your program, Hire KC Youth Summer Initiative, do you provide any training to young people?
Absolutely, yeah. This is important. And the old adage, you know, you want to inspect before you expect, right? So back in late March, we offered with the Kauffman Scholars in a partnership with them at the Kauffman Foundation Convention Center an interview workshop. So we had well over 100 kids show up for a series of rotating workshops on how to interview, how to dress to impress. And we actually brought in Gen KC young professionals to help us out and essentially be closer to their ages, if you will. We also utilize a platform called LRNGKC. You can visit this lrng.org/KC. And what we're using are digital credentials to essentially offer kids a chance to go through a series of experiences online that ask them to produce evidence of understanding. But in the process, they slowly gain these soft skills, these 21st century skills that educators like to talk about.
Oh, that's interesting.
And but it also opens up a new realm of possibility in terms of a new form of currency in a learning economy. And so we have a number of badges out there right now for our interns. Get the job, cha-ching on financial literacy, career exploration and the like. And we're working on more right now for them. Yeah.
Back to some phone calls here. Let's go to Christy from Kansas City, Missouri. Christy, what was your first job? I can hardly hear you, Christy. You there, Christy?
Oh, hi. I'm sorry, Steve. This is Christy.
Yes.
Excuse me. My first job was a local drugstore. We only had one in Chillicothe at the age of 12 or 13.
Right.
And I learned customer service, but also I got the most incredible mentor, a wonderful woman who worked at the store. And years later, when I was graduating from college and I was looking for a real job, she was married to the chief of staff of newly elected Congressman Jerry Litton.
Oh, you're kidding.
And she pushed me over the edge. She said, you have to hire this young person. And the rest is history. And I went to work for him in Washington, D.C. about 5 days after I graduated. So my message is that you never know when you're going to be working and have the opportunity to work with and get to know and impress someone who will change your life.
That's a great story, Nick. That's just what you're getting at here,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay. We go to Steve Glorioso from Kansas City, Missouri. Steven, good morning.
Oh, hi, Steve. My first job was on the railroad.
No kidding.
At the age of 17, using connections even at an early age, my girlfriend's father was the head of the rail union. And he got me the job, and I was making big bucks, union wages, a lot more than my high school buddies. But there was a catch. He put me on the midnight to 8 shift. So he knew every night his daughter would be home by 11:30.
Smart man, Steve.
Yeah, he was a shrewd fella. Anyway, it was a great job. I mean, you know, I wore myself out because I didn't go home and sleep. I'd go out and play tennis with my friends and then sleep for a couple of hours, but made a lot of money.
Good for you. I'm glad you called, Steve. Right. Thanks. Yeah. You know, Nick, I'm wondering, with your program, one of the issues that you're confronting is this idea of the digital divide. Mm-hmm. Not every home has got a computer to connect with the summer job initiative that you're pushing here. How are you dealing with that and trying to overcome it?
Well, that is definitely an issue at large here in town and nationwide. I think there was a Pew Center study that went out in 2015 that showed the percentages of and demographics of who's actually on computers, who's using them. And it's kind of surprising sometimes. I think most importantly is who's using what in terms of their device. Many youth may not have a laptop during the summer, but they do have a phone. And so in many cases, we found that the best way to communicate with youth is through text messages and also some form of mobile website. Beyond that, it's very difficult to compute.
Right.
But during the school year, remember, kids are offered laptops through their schools. It's just maybe helping them bridge that gap in the summer months to help them continue computing.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, back to some calls here. Let's go to Michelle from Raytown. Michelle, we're talking about first jobs. I'm wondering what yours was.
My first job was in Northwest Iowa, roguing corn. You'd walk up and down the rows of corn, and if there was a male corn in a female row, you would take that piece of corn out. And then later in the season, detasseling the corn.
That's real work, Michelle.
Yeah, I really learned the value of hard work and how farmers have a really big job. And so I learned that lesson pretty early.
I'm glad you called. Thank you.
Thanks.
Adrian DeWeese wrote us on Twitter here and writes that her first job was Taco Bell in 2002, progressed to shift leader status, learned the importance of customer service, treating others with respect, also had to balance extracurricular activities and schoolwork with working 30 hours a week. I had a boss who fortunately understood. To see that compassion and an understanding towards trust and work-life balance, it stayed with me. I also learned to laugh and not take things too seriously. Not a week has passed in 15 years that I haven't reflected on what that job taught me. The service industry is hard, but I learned a whole lot. Let's go back to some calls here and Jan from north of the river. Jan, good morning.
Hi there. Yeah, my first job, I was like 16, and I worked as a car hop down at Dog and Suds in Warrensburg.
How did that go for you? Because you were a shy kid,
Pardon?
You were a shy kid. How did you manage it?
Yeah, that was the deal, see. But, you know, it was within walking distance. I didn't have a license or anything yet, no extra car around. And I wanted to work a summer job, and so I just took it. And it was valuable because I learned how to overcome shyness quite a bit. And actually became talkative.
Funny how that happens sometimes.
Because we had the kids, and then there was occasional truckers, and you had the college boys and the Air Force boys, and and they'd tease, and you had to learn how to make comments back and flirt a little bit and look people in the eye and be smiley and nice, and it was really valuable.
Jan, I'm glad you called. Thanks very much.
Back then, I think it was like 50 cents an hour.
Wow.
The cook got $1 an hour. I mean, we're talking 1963, maybe, something like that.
I think you overcame your shyness, Jan. Thanks for the phone call.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Let's go to Mary from Lawrence. Mary, you're on UpToDate, and we're wondering what your first summer job was.
Good morning, Steve. It was 1963 for me, too. Lived in a small town in southeast Kansas, and there weren't many jobs, so I was thrilled to get hired at the swimming pool. Most of the boys just worked for the farmers. My job was to take the clothes that people took off, put them in a basket, and put them on the shelves. And what I mostly learned that summer was how bad farm boys can smell.
That stayed with you all these years, eh?
I'm 67 now, and I think of those boys every year.
Mary, thank you for the call. Stephanie Clayton tweeted us this. She was a restaurant hostess. Her first job, minimum wage was $4.25. She made $5 an hour. I loved earning my own money, she writes. I also learned that I don't smile enough. Got to smile a lot as a restaurant hostess, that's for sure. Let's grab a final call here from David from Vermont, but he commutes to Topeka, I guess. Okay, David, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm well, thanks.
Thanks. My first job was in 1978 when I was 14. I was living in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, with where my dad was working for a large defense contractor. And my job was working for a multinational that was building a housing complex for their workers that worked in Jeddah. It was about a 100-unit complex. And I was working with workers from all over the world, from Italy, from the UK, from several countries in Africa, including Egypt and the Sudan. And this was about the time that the Camp David Accords were going on with President Jimmy Carter and Anwar Sadat. And so my nickname became Camp David with the folks from Africa. But what I really learned was, the esteem in which America is held and the importance of America's leadership in the world, it meant an awful lot to those people who were from, the African continent, that America had taken leadership in, trying to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And it was you could see the meaning that it had for them.
You bet. Thanks for the good call, David.
Thank you, Steve.
Central Standard host Gina Kaufman wrote us this. Technically, my first job was babysitting for the across-the-street neighbors. I learned to ask ahead of time how much you're getting paid. Nick, always a very good idea. Nick, tell us again the contact number for Hire KC Youth Summer Initiative.
Well, better than that, I'll give you the website, and on that they can find it. It's just hirekcyouth.org.
That's a good website to have. That's Nick Dorn. Again, he's Director of Education for KC Youth Social Innovation. Thanks so much for taking some time, Nick.
Thank you for the time.
I
appreciate it.
You bet. Time for a break here. When we come back, we're going to switch topics dramatically. We're going to talk with Aaron Lowe, who decided to compete in this year's National History Day contest. And guess what? She won it. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Tomorrow on the show, we find out how future home technology will help you stay healthy, and we'll discuss a film about internet addiction and its effects on the human psyche. That's part of our Fringe Fest KC preview. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, when Aaron Lowe of Kansas City decided to compete in this year's National History Day contest, she wanted to pick a moment from our collective past that not many people knew about. I'd say she succeeded. Erin, a senior-to-be at Pembroke, picked a little-known story from the British suffrage movement that involved the women learning jujitsu, I'm not kidding, to fight back and defend themselves against police who were attacking them during protests. Well, the story worked for Erin. She placed first in the senior individual performance category at the national finals, and she joins me here. And Erin, nice to have you.
Hi, thank you so much for having
me. You won. Good for you.
Thank you.
It's got to be a great feeling.
Yeah, it's incredible. It's unbelievable.
This is quite a story. How did you come across it?
Well, actually, it's funny. So I had a different topic in mind. I was planning to do National History Day this year, but I was going to focus on Dorothea Dix and her work with the mentally ill.
Ah.
Yeah.
Which would have been a great choice.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to do a very strong woman for my topic this year. And actually, my mom found this article that she thought I'd be interested in because I'm very vocal about my beliefs in my household. And of course, she told me to read it, so I didn't. until a number of weeks later. And I picked up the story, and there was this piece of political propaganda, and it showed this woman. She was 4'11", and she was throwing a police officer over a fence. And so I was intrigued right away.
That would catch your attention, wouldn't it?
Yeah. And so I started researching, and then I realized that this was a story that I had to tell, because if I didn't, who would?
So you saw this story, and did you think to yourself, bingo, I found what I'm looking for here?
Yeah, well, actually, so I wasn't even looking for a topic anymore. And Dorothea Dix is a pretty well-known person, and her work is pretty well-known as well. And so I figured there would be other people to tell her story, and so I should take on the responsibility to tell this one.
So how did you research something that's seemingly this arcane from our distant past? Was there much out there on this?
Yeah, so It didn't seem like it at first, but the more research that you do, it's sort of like this big interconnected web, because the more that you do, the more that you find. And so
that's the way the world works sometimes,
yeah.
Isn't it? Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because obviously I can't fly to England every weekend and, you know, look at hands-on archives, but because of the day and age in which we live in today, you know, the internet is such a helpful source because you can find all these archives online, you can find historical newspapers, you can find so many primary sources, which were so helpful to me in this process.
So this idea of jujitsu and throwing police officers over fence naturally caught your eye. What more did you find out about this? Tell us the rest of the story here.
Yeah. So, okay, it's really interesting. So basically, during the British women's suffrage movement, there was, well, everyone knows about the suffragists.
What year are we talking about?
What year?
Yeah, years, roughly.
The very early 1900s. Prior to 1914.
So a little before this country went through that movement then,
it sounds
like.
Mm-hmm. So this actually predated that a little bit. They kind of happened simultaneously, and I can talk about that, but there's a lot of interconnectivity there. But basically, so a lot of people know about the suffragists, but the suffragettes were actually the militant group that emerged from the suffragists. And so...
What's the distinction?
Well, they're the militant group. So they were actually called suffragettes in a derogatory way, but they embraced it, and they actually started calling themselves suffragettes because we're going to get the vote. So like the suffragettes. But it was very fascinating to me. And so then this smaller movement I discuss is called the Bodyguard, and some people called this group of women Emmeline Pankhurst Amazons. Hmm. And so basically she instructed this woman, Gertrude Harding, to form this group called the Bodyguard. And Edith Garrod was their trainer, and she was a woman that I embodied in my performance. And
because you have to act all this out at this competition you went to.
Yeah, so right. I do the performance category, so I get to embody historical figures, and it's really exciting.
I'm getting the impression you like to act.
Yeah.
You're sort of out there a little bit, and that's a good thing when it comes to what you were trying to do.
Thank you. Yeah. It's very cool because it's experiencing history in this sort of way is different from anything else I've ever experienced. Because, I mean, you can read all these documents, you can watch all these old interviews, but to actually become the character is amazing because you have to look at it from their perspective, you have to look at it from their mindset. And so I think you have to see the things that they did right and wrong, because nobody's perfect, obviously, and history is never going to be unbiased. But you have to do your best to tell the story while feeling the things that they felt.
Yeah, and that really is a great way to learn what you're trying to master here, because when you have to act it, as you're saying, you really have to immerse yourself in what it is you're trying to do.
And I think it really humanizes a lot of these historical figures as well, because when we look at it, we look at their motives and their intentions, and then we see the consequences of a lot of their actions. But I think it's really important to look back first and see where that came from.
Erin Lowe's my guest. She's a senior-to-be at Pembroke, and she just won this year's National History Day contest, in which she had to pick a moment from history and then act it out in front of a panel of judges. So, again, going back to this story here, so why were the police beating up the suffragettes?
Yeah, so...
Why would they do that? All they wanted to do was vote, right? So why would police want to beat them up?
Yeah, so a lot of people didn't want women to receive the vote at this time. And there were basically three main viewpoints regarding women's suffrage at the time. So, of course, there were people who didn't want women to have the vote. And basically,
some people maybe still don't.
Yeah, but there was sort of this cult of domesticity that people didn't want women to emerge from. And then I also read a lot of sources that said how, you know, women weren't considered capable of having the vote. And actually, it's interesting because even when they did receive the vote in 1918, that was only for women over the age of 30. It wasn't until 1928 that it was voting equality. And so in 1918, it was right after the war. And so they only gave the vote to women over the age of 30 because so many men had been lost in the war. They had been in the war and they were afraid of women taking the majority, I guess.
Yeah. This idea that women couldn't vote up until the 1920s or roughly whenever it was, did that surprise you as a young person learning history for the first time? And what did you make of all that?
Well, yeah, I mean,
what a crazy idea that is, at least in retrospect now. Yeah,
definitely. And I mean, it's the most interesting thing, I think, is that it wasn't a new idea. Of course, you know, people had been advocating for women's suffrage for 100 years before this, but no significant headway was made until the early 1900s. And I mean, of course, there were a lot of conflicts going on, and there were a lot of other things in the forefront of political conversation. But this was so important. And I don't know. I think it really makes you think, how could we ignore a group of people for so long?
Yeah.
And how can that impact us today? And how can we move forward from that?
And you can extrapolate that to all kinds of groups in society yeah. that are struggling today. Right. Yeah. So again, going back to the story, why were police beating up these women?
Yeah, so they were instructed to. And basically, the women were peacefully protesting the majority of the time before militancy, you know, came to the forefront. And they would be beaten to the ground and arrested. Mm. And so that's why this other group emerged, because they felt that they needed to fight back. They didn't want to be helpless when it came to these, you know, conflicts. And so a group of about 30 women learned jiu-jitsu. And they trained.
It's such an amazing idea
yeah,
to me.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. It's you haven't really heard of it either. I hadn't heard anything about this until this year.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I think that's why I had to tell the story. But it's so fascinating just because, you know, especially in terms of history, there are a lot of women, female historical figures, but they're not always discussed. And so I thought that this was really important because you don't hear about it all the time. You don't hear, especially in terms of physical confrontations, you don't hear about women, you know, engaging in them.
Well, do you get any sense how successful or how effective these women were when it came to fighting back against the police using their newfound jiu-jitsu? And,
yeah.
And can you do it? Did you ever try it yourself?
I did.
I was going to say, maybe that would help you learn it.
I mean,
it.
I'm not an expert, but I did go and I took a class because I felt that I should learn if I'm, you know, discussing all of these things, these ideas. So I learned a little bit and I hope to go back to those classes and take some more.
That's called method acting, what you're doing.
Of course.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So you could, after the show, you could put me over your shoulder and flip me then, it sounds like.
I mean, I won't.
I would appreciate it. Yeah. So how effective were the women? Were they able to fight back effectively?
Yeah. And it's interesting too, because a lot of times they would be underestimated. So
I bet.
Yeah. There's one story, and basically Edith Garrod, who was the trainer whom I embodied, she was at giving this demonstration, and there was this police officer who volunteered to be a part of the demonstration, and she asked him how much he weighed. And he said, oh, well, you know, I'm under 200 pounds, but, you know, a lot of people in the force, they're over 200 pounds, so, like, you probably wouldn't be able to do anything to them. And she goes, oh, no, the only reason I'm asking is because it's going to hurt a lot more the more that you weigh when I throw you.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Really? And she figured that out then
yeah.
right away. Yeah. And was she able to throw this particular policeman? Or
oh,
do you?
Yeah. Yeah. She was very successful. And, I mean, she was 4'11", and so they never would have expected this, but...
So were there violent clashes then between these women and the police then as time progressed?
There were. One particularly famous one was the Glasgow riot. And also, not all of it was hand-to-hand combat. So a lot of times, you know, women had these, they were called hardwood Indian clubs. And they were originally intended for use within exercise classes, but they could fit within a bustle. and so it was easy for them to carry them around and, you know, fight back that way as well. And also, it was interesting, too, because at some of the protests, you know, there would be, they put wire along with the decorations and everything, with, you know, the purple and white and green decorations in order to protect themselves.
Huh. Well, and were there lots of clashes? Did you come across evidence that police officers were injured in the course of confronting these women?
Yeah, it's just there's a little bit of a discrepancy because it's hard to, you know, categorize because a lot of them were not documented at the time. But I think the main problem was that so many women had been injured, so many women had been arrested, that it was a far smaller number of police officers. But mm-hmm. they were able to protect a lot of their own.
Now, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm just guessing here that your enthusiasm for this topic sort of carried over to your performance in front of the judges at this at this National History Day contest that you took part in.
Yeah.
Am I right?
Definitely.
Yeah, it worked, eh?
Yeah.
And what was the competition like? You had to portray this one woman. There was a second person, too, I think you had to portray?
Yeah. So yeah. I had three characters. It's really important to not only show one side of history, but to sort of give a more holistic representation.
Ah.
So Edith Garrod was clearly pro-militancy because she was the trainer, and she was one of the characters that I embodied. But I also had another character who was a fictional character, but she was based off of a realistic historical viewpoint of the time period.
Ah.
And so her name was Florence, and she was pro-suffrage, but she was against militancy. And then I had a narrator character who sort of tied it into today and brought it all together.
Well, how did you manage to tie all these three different people together for your performance? How did that work?
So it was interesting. So I did a lot of research in the process. And then when I got to the point where I was ready to write my script, I kind of just like to sit down and write it out and then go back and edit it over time. But basically, I knew that I wanted to have more than one character. I knew that I wanted to show different perspectives. And so I tried to figure out a year that I could talk about so many different things. And so I finally decided on 1914 because so much happened. Because the year before, you know, the Cat and Mouse Act was passed, which basically meant that women could be arrested for peacefully protesting. And then a lot of them went on hunger strikes while they were imprisoned. And so then they would be released long enough for them to be weaned back to health. But then they would be recaptured.
Wow.
And so that they wouldn't become martyrs for the cause.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think it just was a lot of trying to tie it together.
Your presentation was something like, what, 10 minutes long?
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't sound like a long time, but it is a long time when you're trying to do what you were trying to do, right?
Yeah, it's interesting, though, because I always end up writing too much, and then I have to condense it to this 10-minute period or talk really fast, which is not good because then no one can understand you. But
yeah
it's I ended up at 9 minutes and 59 seconds in the final round at Nationals, I think. So
what would have happened if you had gone over?
I think they deduct points or something if you go over. But
yeah. And did your mom sitting here with you in the studio, did she help you sort of navigate this script as you went through it? How did that work?
She gave me a lot of support, and I love her with all my heart. But actually, I kind of refused to show her my performance until like right before the competition, because I sort of like to work it out in my head first.
Yeah.
And I think it's really important to be in the mindset of the characters. So I kind of wrote it and then practiced it on my own, and then she was supportive, and she was always there and in the audience. But
did you have to memorize this thing?
Yeah.
That's a lot to memorize, too.
Yeah, memorizing things, though.
How did you manage all this with your other studies at Pembroke?
Well, so it's a lot of balance and not a lot of sleep. But, and actually, a couple of my friends, I had to be like, oh, well, it was nice knowing you. I'll see you in June.
Yeah.
And so it took a lot of time and a lot of energy, but it's something that I'm really passionate about. So I think it was definitely worth it. And it's something that I would do over and over.
And when you won it, how did it feel?
It felt unreal. I mean, obviously, that's always been a dream, but I never really thought that it could happen.
Yeah.
So it was very exciting. And actually, there's this moment in the awards ceremony footage when so at the awards ceremony, there's like this big ceremony and everyone from all the affiliates wears like things from their states and we all have flags and stuff. And so this Missouri state insect is the honeybee. So like a couple of us were wearing antennae. And I was so overwhelmed when they called my name that when I ran down during the award ceremony, they were trying to put the medal on and I had the antennae on. And there was a very awkward moment on the footage. But
so just quickly, how's this going to help you in the future?
Yeah.
Having won this National History Day contest.
So I definitely think that I want to pursue history, and I want to go, and I know everyone says they want to make a difference, but I really feel like it's possible because I was able to do this. And I think that this competition is so important because it not only encourages young people to look at history, but it shows them the importance of it and shows them that we have to look back in order to move forward. And I think that's something that we have to take with us if we want to succeed as a society.
That's a great lesson and a great way to end this segment. Erin Lowe of Kansas City, a winner of the National History Day contest. She'll be a senior at Pembroke. Thanks for coming in and sharing your story. Really enjoyed having you. What a great victory.
Oh, thank you so
Thanks
much for
so
having
much.
Me.
You bet. Coming up, Bill Brownlee in this week's Local Listen. KCUR contributor Bill Brownlee is back with this week's Local Listen. And ¿qué pasa, Bill? How are you?
Buena, Steve.
Well, yeah. You want to talk about Jake Wells. Tell us about Jake Wells.
Well, like your previous guest here, he's a very impressive young Kansas City troubadour.
No kidding.
He's handsome. He's talented. Needless to say, I despise him.
Why not, right? This is Roll Like Thunder, the single released in 2016 from Jake Wells.
So roll like thunder and leak like fire. And fall like the rain down, down, down. Well, I think I'm insane now, 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 now. Yeah. You run away. No way to think I got away.
Wow. Wow, Jake Wells, Roll Like Thunder. That's impressive.
Yeah, there's something happening in those grooves, isn't there?
Oh, no kidding. Yeah. Tell us a little more about him.
Well, there's not much to say. He's just getting started. He's released just a handful of songs, this being the most notable of them.
And this thing is blowing up on Spotify, right? 500,000 plays?
Right. He's been added to playlists for this that focus on this, you know, new folk sound that was sort of started by Bon Iver about 10 years ago or so. You know, so we've got this folk music with these subtle contemporary flourishes in the production.
And Jake has only released 3 songs?
Yeah, so, you know, his career could go any direction. You know, it's unclear even if, you know, how willfully he's going to pursue this, because he could go to college or something if, you know, if he wanted to. He's that age.
You know, he's a Kansas City artist, and I'm wondering, do you think that's a good thing or a bad thing, you know, Bill, for an emerging folk artist?
I don't think it matters anymore. You know, everyone's an international artist with the internet and what, you know, services like Spotify and YouTube can do. You know, his big challenge, I think, Steve, is that there are literally, you know, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of artists a lot like this. Now, not all of them have this amazing voice we're hearing or this ability to transport the listener to another place, but competition's fierce.
Well, that's a skill, though. Jake Wells performs on the patio stage of the Riot Room on Thursday. You wonder if he can translate this sound to the live stage.
I think he can. I mean, that voice works anywhere, and, you know, that ability just to lay back like he's doing here and not rush through a song is something I think he can replicate tomorrow afternoon.
Well, it's not often that I hear a song and it just sort of stops you, and this one is stopping me.
Yes, I understand. I'm with you.
That's Bill Brownlee talking about Jake Wells, that track again, Roll Like Thunder. Bill, thanks very much.
Thanks, Steve.
Tomorrow on the show, how new home technologies can help keep you healthy, and we'll get another preview of Fringe Fest as we discuss a film about internet addiction. Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Marlia Campbell produce our program. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.